You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the 3CR Garden Show on what is a very wintry and wet spring weekend. I think yesterday it was the coldest November day in something like, it was over 100 years. So extraordinarily cold blasts coming through. So if you're listening live to the podcast, I hope all is well in your part of the world, but for those listening live, it is a particularly cool start to a 3CR Sunday morning. In the studio, my name's John Arnott, and in the studio this morning we have three terrific garden show panellists. We have Craig Wilson from Gentiana Nursery in Alinda. Thanks, Craig, for coming in.
Morning, John. It's the sort of morning that only a gardener would love.
Because it's been raining.
Yes.
I don't know how many. Have you got a rain gauge? Have you actually?
No, I don't have anything sophisticated like that. I go and look in the wheelbarrow.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, how much water was in the wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
Good on you, Craig. Thanks for coming in. We have Greg Balderson from Forest Glade Nursery in Macedon, a man of many talents, as we'll find out over the next hour and a half. Thanks for
morning.
Coming in. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good,
I've been
good.
Enjoying the rain too. It's hopefully making up a little bit for what we missed out on earlier this year.
Indeed. Yeah. Has it been extra rainy in and around
for this time of the year? It has been, yeah. Extra cool, an extra sort of rainy just for the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, I reckon. There's still like stuff coming out now that usually is finished now. Especially in the bulbs,
the ixias
and gladys and things like that. Yeah, they've just held off a little bit longer. So usually where you might be thinking of whippersnipping them down and they're still growing.
Terrific. And I'm pretty sure this is a correct statement. We've got Amy Downey from the Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne. And this is you've been involved with the show for a little while doing the producing.
Yes.
Welcome, Amy Downey, to the 3CR Garden Show as a guest presenter.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me, and good morning all.
Well, it's lovely to have you come in, and look, we've got some really cool stuff to talk about later with the entire panel. But welcome to the show, Amy.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So if we and Pia and Doug in the control room, thanks for coming in, folks. We had to sort of cobble a bit of a panel together because today was going to be an outside broadcast out of the Yarra Valley Plant Fair, and for a whole bunch of reasons that wasn't actually possible. So we're doing a conventional studio, not outside broadcast show. So thanks all for coming in at short notice. Really appreciate it. What have we got here? We actually have a really nice show lined up for today. We've got a couple of special callers phoning in, including Peter Symes, who's going to be talking about a project that he's working with in the Gaza Strip. I mean, Pete's doing that remotely, of course, but there's some really interesting things happening. The project is called the Global Gardens for Peace, and so we'll be checking with Peter later in the show to talk about the Global Gardens for Peace project. I think we might get a report from the Yarra Valley Plant Fair. I think Chloe might be calling in a little bit later. She's out there selling her books this weekend. Cracking show lined up. Thanks for coming in. Amy, we might just start with you.
Sure.
How long have you been at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Victoria?
It's crazy, actually. I've been there now for over 7 years, which is absolutely wild. It has flown. But I sort of started as an apprentice, so I did 2.5, nearly 3 years there as an apprentice, and then was very fortunate as I was sort of coming up to the end of my apprenticeship to be able to apply and get a sort of qualified position there. And then sort of took on the role as curator of the Grey Garden and the Camellia collection. So it's sort of been this absolutely wild journey that's been so much fun and so much has happened, I feel like, in 7 years. It's just absolutely flown. It's crazy.
It's a pretty special place, isn't it, working in a botanic garden?
Yeah.
In amongst all of these botanic gardeners.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I definitely think as well the horticulturalists that we're working with, like just the best of the best. Like they are so knowledgeable, so inspiring, so exciting, if that makes sense. Like they kind of make you excited to be there, and the discussions that we have are just incredible. Like it's just the best place to work and the best people to kind of be working with. There's so much to talk about and so much to see and so much to learn as well.
Yeah, there sure is.
Yeah.
And the Grey Garden, I mean, that's a really interesting garden. Yeah. So for those that might not know, the Grey Garden is out towards the Temple of the Winds.
Yep.
And it's it is all grey and silver foliage plants.
Yes.
Tell us about the Grey Garden.
Oh, yes. I actually was so fortunate that sort of I was able to, I guess, as I got the role, become the curator, because it was one of those collections when I was an apprentice. It just stood out for me. Like, I loved it so, so much. It's just beautiful and sort of set as well on one of the highest and the hottest spots in the gardens, which I love because I really struggle in the cold, so it felt perfect. But it's such an interesting collection because it really is one of the most diverse collections, I would say, in the gardens, because as you said, like it's a lot of grey foliage plants. So really it can be sort of any sort of plant. It could be a cactus or it could be a salvia. As long as it has grey foliage, it can be from anywhere in the world. That's the only criteria.
So it's not about a group of plants or plants that come from a particular geographic area.
Yep. It could be native. It could be exotic. It can be anything.
It's a potpourri of grey foliage.
Yes, exactly.
And does it extend into the shade?
What was that?
Does it extend into the shade?
Yeah, we have some shady areas. It is sort of a north-facing, very hot exposed spot, mm-hmm. but we do have some trees and things there, so there is a little bit of shade there. Mm-hmm. Low water, though. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's probably the absolute opposite of some of the conditions that Greg's gardening in.
Pretty much, yeah.
In terms of kind of cool, temperate, wet.
Where I am at home can be pretty hot and dry.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you're used to this too, Craig's, the shade and the big trees and shade and higher rainfalls and south-facing slopes and the sun sets at 3 o'clock in the afternoon
And I love grey plants that'll grow in the shade.
Yeah.
It's really special.
Yeah.
What are some?
Brachyglottis.
Brachyglottis ripanda.
Ripanda, rangiora.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's a beauty.
Now, that's a
New Zealand native.
New Zealand native with big leaves.
Is it a daisy? Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's one of those woody herbaceous.
Well, in that case, like this
woody, shrubby.
In the daisy family too, the Illyria, Australian native Illyrias have beautiful silver underfoliage, so you can enjoy it from the ground, but it's not necessarily silver from the top.
The musk daisy bush.
Yeah, musk daisy, which I think's the largest growing member of the daisy family in the world.
It'd be up there.
It'd be close to the Brachyglottis, though, I reckon, because they get pretty big too, don't they?
They do.
There's some things in Mexico, the Podocyniums and some of those, you know, they get pretty big.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, that it's Illyria agarophylla, I think. You see those, in places like Turrbal National Park. And the bases of them.
Yeah, they have those lignotubers so they can survive fire.
It's a lignotuber.
There's some up in Mount Macedon. They look like rhododendrons. It's like walking through a rhododendron plantation. And the trunks on them can be, you know, sometimes 2 metres across with about 15 or 20.
Oh, my gosh.
This is a daisy. You know,
50, 60 centimetre size trunks coming out of this huge lignotuber. And the lignotuber might be, I don't know, 200-300 years old, who knows? But and they've been through at least a couple of fires because you can see the old burnt out bits and hollows and stuff in them. Yeah, amazing plant.
Yeah.
But another, it's not silver from the top, but underneath, when you're walking underneath them, it's all silver up above. Yeah, they're beautiful.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Yeah. Plectranthus argentatus, is that in the Great Garden?
Yes, yeah, it definitely used to be. I wonder if it might have died out actually where it was. But yeah, we've got it in a few other spots of the gardens too, but that's a really lovely one as well.
What would be your top five grey plants for a garden?
Well, okay, great question. I definitely have noticed at the moment that echiums are really catching my eye. So okay. As part of the grey garden is also the grey garden escarpment, which is kind of a steep sloping area. And it's dotted with these amazing echium simplex, which are sort of the lovely large flower spike that's covered in white flowers. Do you know the one?
Is echium simplex... That's different to the common garden variety echium?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it is different. Yeah, this is sort of, it's a biannual and it's just one giant flower spike. Okay. It's just covered in white flowers. It's beautiful. So I would definitely say echium and also echium wild pretii. They're two that I've seen.
They're gorgeous, aren't they?
Loving it at the moment. It's looking amazing.
Does that rate all one or two plants in your top five?
Okay, we'll do one.
One. Okay. Two.
And then number two, I would say Centuria cineraria.
Nice.
You know that one.
Nice.
Lovely, beautiful purple flower. Stunning. So tough. Again, one of the ones that was just naturally growing in the grey garden, and then we trialled it on the escarpment too, which is such a tough spot.
Yeah.
Thriving. Doing super, super well. It's amazing.
Fantastic.
Number three, I would say... Just because it's so interesting, Acacia aphylla.
Okay.
Do you know the one? Kind of an interesting, sort of really unusual looking acacia. It's sort of very, it's quite spiky in a sense and leafless.
And I think aphylla literally means without foliage.
Right. Yeah. Oh, well, right. Perfect. It makes so much sense. Yeah.
The leafless acacia.
Yes. Yeah. And there are some beautiful acacias as well throughout. So they definitely stand out for me.
Okay. Just a couple more.
No, a couple more. There's almost too many to pick from. I think I have to say, so sort of at the top of the grey garden, there's a new garden bed called City Gate that's just gone in. And we've put in, with Tim Ubergang, who's been on the show, sort of helped with the planting design. And they selected some Pandanus utilis.
Amazing.
In there. Yeah, fantastic. Which are doing really, really well. So I think they were trialled maybe a few years ago in the gardens and then whatever happened and now they've come back and just... Oh, stunning, almost a glow around the outside of the foliage.
Beautiful.
Like, just beautiful. Anyway, sorry. And then I would say the final one, because there's a bit of a story to it, but is the Bismarckia nobilis, the Bismarck palm.
Okay.
So this was one that we got down. It grows really well in Queensland, yep. And it's a Madagascan palm. And a couple of years ago, we ordered some. We got it down from Queensland, three of them, and we thought, perfect. This is a really climate-suited species. It's going to love these really hot conditions of the grey garden. It'll be great.
Yep.
When we planted them, it was a super, super wet winter.
Of course it was.
And then we went into a super wet summer. They hated it.
Mm.
They died. I thought all three of them died. It was disaster.
Right.
But I've left them. It's been 2 years now, and I just left one just in case.
Yep.
And I noticed the other day it's got a new frond.
Pushing out a new frond. It's back.
It's back. So that I'll name that as my final one. I'm so happy that it survived, and they're beautiful.
Okay. Question without notice. Any grey foliage that catch your attention?
I used to love the tulips. Some of the tulip species with glaucous blue grey leaves, tulipa. Oh, I can't think of the name now. It has a beautiful red flower,
grey foliage,
and a blue grey foliage with a red edge to it, and also the alliums. There's some really pretty alliums that have
nice.
Is it Henrichii? I think has a blue grey leaf with a red edge on it. I think I like the blue-grey with the red edge. So, and there's a few bulbs that do that.
And Craig, any grey foliage that you a grey foliage plant that you find outstanding?
Tanacetum densum amani.
Say again.
Tanacetum densum amani.
Tanacetum.
It's an alpine plant from the Mediterranean.
Okay.
And it looks like the sort of plant which would be really easy to establish.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Do you sell it?
Yeah, I do.
Right.
Yeah. And Artemisia canescens.
Oh, yes, yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to go past the Artemisias, yes. Yeah. Isn't it, for grey foliage?
Artemisias, yep. And Tanacetums, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is a correlation or an association between grey foliage and dry tolerant. It's not always the case. You can get grey foliage things that aren't.
Yep.
And that's evolutionary, is that what?
Yes, yeah, so a lot of them have the adaptation. So a lot of grey foliage plants have maybe like the fine hairs on their leaves or powdery, waxy coating, and that sort of helps them to repel the rays of the sun and then retain more water. So
sunscreen.
Yes, perfect way to describe it, exactly.
SPS factor 50.
The other one that I love is Stelia chrotamica.
I don't know.
Chatham Islands, Australia.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is a shade plant.
Oh, wow.
It's a grassy.
It's strap leaf.
Strap leaf.
Yeah, grassy would be. The leaves are quite broad.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And quite slow.
Yeah.
But it's a giant lily, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to look into it. It sounds amazing. Wow.
And there's an Australian native. I don't know. I'm assuming that it has links to sort of the Gondwana thing because there's Astelias in New Zealand, certainly. Yeah. There's Astelias in Australia.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple in New Caledonia.
Don't know about that. I know that I have the one that was indigenous to the Dandenongs in my garden, Astelia australis, which is extinct now in the Dandenongs.
Yeah.
Oh.
Still occurs in around Bunyip.
In the Otways.
And in the Otways.
That's right.
So there's these two populations.
Yeah, and really slow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a spectacular plant.
Of course, it's an Astelia.
But the Astelia you're talking about, is that a much smaller one?
No, like it's
a little
big.
Alpine? It's
one of the little classics. Alpine one is from Tasmania, Astelia banksii.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, we could probably spend the whole show talking about grey foliage plants.
I would love that.
Well, thanks. And the other area that you look after is the camellia section, but you've taken that on more recently?
Yes. I've had it for a few years and it's definitely an area that I look after, and I'm very fortunate to have volunteers, especially Jenny Happel, who is the camellia expert, I would say, that works very closely with me. So
how lovely.
She's amazing, and she's been sort of seen the collection through many a curator and been there the whole time. So really, I could not do it without her. And again, I'm still sort of learning in that collection and in that area. So she's an amazing person to have with me and be teaching me.
So staff have come and gone, but Jenny
Jenny's
has been
always
the constant.
Stayed. Exactly. She's the connection for us with, you know, Camellia Art, Camellia Society. She, is amazing. We would not be able to be thriving without her.
The diversity of camellias commercially is appalling.
That wasn't always the case.
No, we had Camellia Lodge,
yeah,
which was a phenomenal nursery.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. But nowadays it's just reduced to a handful of Sasanquas.
Such a shame. Yeah, that's really disappointing.
Have you got any theories as to why that has happened? Is it just because of the big barn? Or camellias being perceived as...
Well, the same thing's happened to the roadies too, isn't it? So we used to have all these specialised roadie nurseries and you don't anymore. Mm-hmm. And some of it come... Sorry, Craig?
The roadies I kind of get.
Yeah, me
too. Because they have such a limited range.
Yes, I think that was more the weather patterns changing and people not being able to grow them as well anymore. Yeah.
They're not as a resilient...
No.
Resilient plant as, say, camellias, particularly.
But I think in a lot of people's minds, maybe they lump camellias in with roadies.
Yeah.
So they just assume that, you know, if they can't grow roadies, they can't grow camellias either, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Without knowing the full sort of broad spectrum of the
tolerances
genes
of.
in that gene pool. Yeah.
I mean, it may be as a result of those dreadful pink japonicas that hold their dead flowers.
Mm.
Right, that was the jump the shark moment for camellias.
Yeah.
Dear. Yeah.
I have quite a few of them in my garden, all small flowered ones.
Right.
Quite a lot.
So they're probably closer to the species or?
Species or first crosses.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And the focus of the camellia collection at the Melbourne Gardens is there a particular focus? Is there a range of camellias? Is it species? Is it things from a particular area?
So it's interesting that you're saying about the camellias and rhodos being sort of put together, because we have the camellia and the rhododendron bed. So the camellia collection is sort of throughout the gardens, and I think we have over 900 different camellias there.
900?
Which is crazy. But we do have the dedicated collection which has the camellia bed and the rhododendron bed. So the sort of way it's split up is that the camellia bed is more of the cultivars.
Okay.
More cultivar focused, and yep. then the species are in the rhododendron bed. That's kind of how it's broken up.
And some in the southern China section?
Yes, yep. some in southern China. A lot in Gardens House. Right. So some that were, you know, there's many that are still thrriving today that were planted by guilfoyle. So some really rich history of camellias throughout the whole gardens.
Hang on a sec. Planted by guilfoyle. So this material is over 100 years old.
Yes. Yep. Especially in Gardens House, there's so many that are still thriving. Again, thriving, not just surviving.
Yeah, they do well. They don't seem to ever. So Mount Macedon has quite a few well over 100 years that are, they just do their thing.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
Just these huge, you know, 5-10 meter tall, or maybe not 10, but big stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big bushes. And they look as healthy as the day they were planted, probably. Yeah.
Forest Glade? Forest Glade
has individual plants. I'm not very familiar with hybrids of the camellias. Individual plants. So there's hundreds and hundreds of individual plants. There'd be a pretty good selection of hybrids. From the japonicas and the sasanqua and all sorts of things. There's probably not too many species ones there. I can't actually think of any. Mm. There's quite a large selection of hybridised camellias there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're all doing
the beautiful thing about old camellias is the bark.
Yes, yeah, the trunks are amazing, yeah.
That's right.
Actually saying that, one of my favourite camellias, it's got a terrible name and I always try to say it a bit pretty, but it never comes out nice, but it's Camellia crapnelliana.
Crapnelliana.
Yes. I mean, is there a nice way to say it? I don't know.
Well, I think you just said it as nicely as you could.
But it's got this amazing orange bark on it. It's absolutely beautiful and it's one of my favourites. It's so sort of bright and orange. A lovely camellia anyway, but the bark is such an interesting feature.
I have crapnelliana in my garden.
Do you? For the bark. Beautiful. For the bark, exactly. Yeah, it's stunning.
And then there's, we could speak for the rest of the show about camellias. Then there's the yellow-flowered Southeast Asian.
Yes, Nitidissima as well.
Chrysantha?
Yes, yep.
Yep.
Yes, I wonder if that one was maybe at Fernie Creek. I might be making that up, but I remember someone saying that as well. But they are such a hit and, again, beautiful. So sort of, I was really surprised to see a yellow flowering camellia when I was sort of first learning about it. They are beautiful. And we've got a couple different ones too where some have really tiny, like really delicate small yellow flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the corner, which is such a hit, is the sort of big main Camellia nitidissima, which is just beautiful.
A stunner.
Really hard to find commercially.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
I think they've definitely, we've just recently sort of gone around to select what they're going to sell at the Friends Growing Sale that they have at the gardens, and that they've added that to the list. So hopefully that might be a good spot people could get it if they're interested in some yellow.
And there is the Japonica Brushfields Yellow, which has a hybrid from Nitidissima, but it's very double.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's not very elegant, is it?
No, it's not very elegant at all. I wouldn't plant it.
No.
When you say not very elegant, it's...
Oh, you know, some plants, you just look at them and you go, yeah, I'm good. It's just, there's just something about, there's certain camellias that, we're talking hybrid ones here, that where the way the flower sits on the bush and the shape of the flower and the colours there, even whether it's fully doubled or a single one, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're aesthetically pleasing, and then other times they're like, yeah, that's okay.
100% with you. Yeah.
It's just, it's not a pretty bush, I don't think.
No.
I'm sure it's got its uses. It's just that, not for me.
And it's interesting to note, perhaps people know this or don't know this, but tea is a camellia species. So the tea that we drink as a cup of tea,
yes,
it's actually a species of camellia. It's Camellia sinensis.
Sinensis.
Yeah.
Camellia sinensis.
Yeah.
And it's the new growth, which is...
Camellia size beautiful too. That's a really pretty camellia.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But it's amazing, isn't it? You drink tea all your life and then you go, oh, that's a camellia.
It's a camellia.
It's becoming one of the mainstays of the Rwandan economy.
Is that right?
Tea. Yeah.
Okay.
It's interesting. They have two regions that they grow it. One is for tea bags and the other one is for fine tea. And the fine teas has a bit of higher altitude.
So that'd be different cultivars?
Different cultivars, right. Yeah. Okay. But also to do with altitude, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
We really could spend the next hour and a half talking about camellias, couldn't we? Amy, just something that's come up on here, saying, loving hearing Amy's enthusiasm and knowledge on the radio.
Oh, so, thank you. Well played. That's so lovely.
Great
thank
start.
You.
It's great having you here.
Thanks so much.
Craig, I had a look at your website the other day, last night, and there were a couple of terms. I mean, you've got so much plant diversity. Have you got a sense of how many different plants you grow?
I wouldn't have a clue.
Like ballpark?
Not that organised.
Ballpark? Over 1,000?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, it'd fit into a ballpark.
I don't know.
But there were some terms for different sort of styles of gardens or plants that sort of fit a particular style of garden. And there was a couple of terms that I didn't know, and I thought I could Google them, but I'll just go straight to the source. Mm-hmm. What is a Cusimano garden style?
A planting which is put together on a semi-permanent, perhaps temporary basis, which is displayed with bonsai.
Okay, so it's a bonsai...
It's a potted arrangement of herbaceous plants.
Okay.
That's put on for exhibition.
So it is an art form?
It's absolutely an art form.
Right. How do you pronounce it properly?
Cusimano.
Cusimano.
That's correct, yeah.
And that's a Japanese garden technique?
Very much so.
But not using woody things? Because I had a look at the list and there was lots of really alpine things.
Rarely they use woody stuff. They might use azalea, say it to me, you know, the non-flowering sasaki.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that, but rarely woody. They're fairly temporary. They use grasses and a stilbe and small hostas and things like that.
So a bit like a show garden. No?
It's in your hand.
Oh, it's tiny.
Yeah, it's in your hand.
Please explain.
Well, it's when you're exhibiting the bonsai, you have a specific space.
Yeah.
That you're allowed to exhibit, and maybe you would put a scroll behind it.
So it's on that scale?
It's on that scale, and then it would sit below the bonsai.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
In a small, shallow pot.
To play off the bonsai?
Absolutely, to enhance the tree.
Right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I was up last week, it was the Australian New Zealand Botanic Garden Conference, and we went to Canberra and visited the National Arboretum, and they've got the National Bonsai Collection there. And I believe that you've had or have some of your bonsais exhibited in the National Collection?
Yeah, quite a few in the past, not so much now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you recall the species?
Banksia integrifolia, they really want that one.
Yeah.
Pinus radiata, which I love. I love growing weeds as bonsai. Carpinus betula.
Okay.
Yeah. A few things.
Producer Doug, came into the studio before, and I think he knew that you're a bonsai fella, and said, I've got a lily pilly, it's a bonsai one, do you want it? And you said, no, because it'd be a life sentence.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, bonsai happens over decades and decades and decades.
It's not a dissimilar process to planting a tree in the ground, you know, it takes 30 years before you get a good one.
Yeah.
60 years, they start getting really good.
What's your oldest bonsai? Have you got a sense for...
Yeah, I do. I know them all. 1964.
Okay.
Japanese palmatum, which obviously I bought. Yeah. I bought them for the bark. They weren't particularly good trees, but they had beautiful old bark.
Hang on, so 1964, that makes that a 61-year-old plant.
Yeah, just starting to get good.
It's in adolescence.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it is really, isn't it?
Yeah, like absolutely
the aim.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
Because they're intergenerational.
They are.
Like, that's what the aim is, at least, anyway, yeah.
And, Greg, you've dabbled in bonsai?
Oh, ever since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And we have bonsais at Forest Glade.
Okay.
There's a couple there, which, because I'm not there all the time and everyone's scooting around doing their own things, occasionally the watering system will break down and we'll lose... like a very nice one, which is heartbreaking.
That can't happen.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, my favourite thing I've done with, I won't call them bonsais, I'm sure they've got an appropriate name, is actually planting out landscapes with clipped trees. So it okay. looks like a what I would call a bonsai garden, but I'm sure it's got a correct term.
Niwaki.
Yeah, so that's my my thing I like doing, yeah.
Well, bonsai is one of those things, is I think it's like most Japanese art forms where there is incredible complexity to make something that is in appearance so simple.
But that race, that I looked at these things in the National Collection, and they're 100 years old, some of these things. Yeah. And there's just so little resource, like potting mix, growing media resources, that on a hot day, you'd be watering that 3 or 4 or even more times. Is that right? Or
you'd have to be really hot to do it twice.
Right, yeah. Okay.
I mean, the main thing is to keep feeding them. You can't grow something in that smaller container if it's not fed frequently.
But yeah. feeding would push out bigger foliage?
That's what you have scissors for.
I clearly miss the bonsai gene.
The dwarfing process is all through pruning.
All through pruning?
Yep, 100% pruning.
But constricting the root space as well?
Well, you're only doing that every few years, or where the clipping's constant. Like if it's growing, you're clipping it.
That's right. But the root pruning is done in order to create new feeder roots,
okay.
so you can feed them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what you see on the surface is roots for aesthetic value. Anything below the soil is a white feeder root. And then I read that book, The Hidden Life of Trees, and I discovered that trees' brains are in their roots.
Right.
And I suddenly felt that perhaps I am being cruel.
You're bottomising.
Because you hear that, you know, bonsai is a form of plant torture. I mean, that's...
bullshit.
Well, yeah.
Well, so is hedging, though, and everyone's got hedges.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mowing a lawn is a form of...
I've spent a lot of time on stage talking and lecturing people about bonsai, and when I get the charge of cruelty, I tell them to go to Erinundra and protest about the logging of old-growth forests because that is cruel.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's genocide on a whole ecosystem.
Yeah, for sure. But it's the ultimate in plant manipulation.
It's the ultimate in horticulture, and it is so intimate. I mean, the understanding that you have of your plants is beyond anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you know what's below the soil and what's above it.
And you know the plant's history.
You know every branch. You've trained every branch.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
How beautiful.
How beautiful. Well, good on you for having some material up at the National Bonsai Collection.
Did you enjoy the collection?
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Amazing. In fact, I enjoyed the Bonsai Collection, the National Collection of Bonsai, probably more than I enjoyed the 250-hectare landscape. To be honest, it was so beautiful, and you can see the skill and the craft, and it's there's volunteers there that are interpreting the collections, telling the stories that sit behind the holdings.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah, Greg, you grew up in Macedon.
Mm-hmm.
You're still in Macedon.
Mm-hmm.
You know everything about everything. You're a field naturalist? Would you call yourself a field naturalist?
I don't know. I don't know what to call me.
but you're interested in
I like natural science of any
natural
sort.
Science.
Doesn't matter if it's astronomy or geology or biology or mycology or whatever it is. I find that stuff interesting.
What is it about Macedon that you find so compelling?
I think it's because I grew up there. Like forest glades. Less than 100 metres from my bedroom where I grew up. So I'm working, you know, 2 or 3 days a week in a garden that I literally grew up in. I spent a lot of time in there as a kid.
Yep.
I spent a lot of time in the forest as a kid. Like the down the end of my road is still my favourite place to go down into the gully and walk up the creeks and look for mushrooms and get bitten by leeches and whatever it is. But it's – and then you start wondering – why does all the rock look the same in this gully, but it's different up the top there? Mm. Or, you know, why does the landscape look like it does? What happened here? How old is it? And then you just yeah, you start off with, like, why did they cut all the trees down here over 100, you know, just over 100 years ago? And then it's like, what was here before then?
Mm.
And what was here before that? And that story goes back in our region about 500 million years.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's...
And 2,000-odd generations of human
habitation. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's that whole story's what interests me, I guess. And because it's a place I grew up in and already know a bit about, when you can, you know, find out, you find out more stuff if you're in the same spot.
If you're curious.
If you're curious about that.
If you're curious.
And I think, for me anyway, it's important to know the narrative of the place I live.
Mm.
It's story through time, whether recent in, you know, hundreds of years or thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions and, you know, hundreds of millions even. It's an amazing story. And it doesn't matter where you live. Yeah. Like, you could pretty much anywhere that you live, if you start learning about the geology in your area, you'll find something very interesting that's worthwhile.
So you grew up there, you're still there. We were talking about climate. You know, there was a bit of chat around climate on the show last week. Have you seen shifts, like just in your observations of Macedon and the bushland?
Yeah, well, like we were mentioning before, the rhododendron nursery that Cyril, the owner of Forest Glade, bought, there's something, I think at one point, and I don't know if it's the number that's in the garden now, but over the years he bought something like 40, 50, 60,000 individual rhododendrons and azaleas to plant in the garden.
Wow.
And that nursery doesn't exist. I can't remember the name of the nursery. It was up in the Dandenongs. We see troubles now which weren't there in the 90s of malaria and Phytophthora knocking out the roadies.
Mm.
And there's no point replacing them because the new ones will probably just get eaten as well. Mm-hmm. And there's 70,000 of them, so you can probably lose a few to make some room. A good Mount Macedon's actually a really good example, because at the very top of Mount Macedon there's a volcanic plug that's only about 6 million years old. And on top of that grows a struggling community of snow gums.
Mm.
And that's a remnant from the last ice age. So they've, you know, 10, 12,000 years ago, most of Mount Macedon was probably covered in alpine ash and snow gum.
Snow gums, yeah.
And now you only find them in the top 100 metres or so, which is a fairly small...
On one face.
Right up the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, right up on the top ridge line, there's pretty big plantings of alpine ash still, but there's only a couple of little splashes of these...
Of the porties.
And that's happened over 10,000 years. Yep. And they're probably not going to survive what might happen over 100 years because... Plants can't go, oh, it's a bit hot here now, I might
just go further up the hill,
pack my bags and to have a bit of a hike and you know, it's a stranded community as well. It's nowhere near the, they can't go uphill anymore, they're at the top. So that's one example of what would probably affect Mount Macedon. And it's, I think we were talking before too, it's about the, not necessarily that it's definitely going to get hotter and drier, it's that we don't know. It could be, you know, you might get a little pocket where you're lucky and you had pretty hot, dry conditions and now they're a bit wetter and you can grow more stuff. But it's that variation. And I think I mentioned before the show, we were having a quick chat about it, and I mentioned it's, we're out of equilibrium.
Mm.
And when you knock something...
In terms of climate.
In terms of climate, yeah. And if you knock something out of equilibrium, it swings.
Yep.
And you don't know where it's going to swing.
No.
And it takes a long time for that to settle back down.
Yep.
And we're out of equilibrium. So we might get tornadoes. Like there's a tornado channel just north of Mount Macedon, and occasionally you'll get... We don't call them tornadoes because we don't usually get them in Australia, and they're not quite as severe as the ones you get in the US, but they're there.
Yeah.
And
there was one in Werribee 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so there might be areas that get more of those, which can be really destructive. Or, you know, you might get 3 years of horrible drought and then 3 years of way too much rain.
Mm.
And so you're not, it's not about, oh, it's going to get hotter and drier. It's going to get hotter and wetter in some places. It's going to get drier and colder in other places.
Or windier.
Windier, yeah. Floods,
yeah.
You know, years of drought, which make the forest more prone to bushfire. If you burn, like you said, Mount Masson's an island, as far as ecology goes. If you introduce fire to that too often on the southern slopes where the, these little patches of cool climate rainforest are, they'll be gone.
They'll be gone.
Because they won't be able to, that sort of forest can't cope with that much burning.
Well, that's why they've survived in those refugia, because they've been devoid of fire.
For a long time. And that's only a small little island. Like, there's huge patches of those forests, which we're also cutting down, like Craig mentioned before, at a horrible rate.
Plant abuse. Not like bonsai, which is just plant manipulation.
And that type of forestry, I'm sure our practices in Australia are better than some places in the world, but they're only looking at the health of the tree that they're harvesting. So when they go, oh, no, the forests are really healthy, we can cut them down, they grow back really well and whatever. When you start looking at the ecology, the fungi in the ground and the plant diversity in there, a lot of that stuff's gone.
Yep.
It's just the regnans and a couple of other species that can cope with that harvesting
regime.
It also denies birds and animals the nesting hollows.
Yes.
By taking out the old trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You listen to the 3CR Garden Show. This is a wonderful panel this morning. We've got some terrific conversations that we're having. If you'd like to contribute to any of these conversations, or if you've got a comment or you have a gardening question at all, feel free to call in. We'll open the lines. The number to call to chat with the panel this morning is 94190155. There's a couple of text messages that have come through, so I'll have a look at those in a second. But you can text a question through to the text line, which is 0488 809 855. And the couple of questions that have, the couple of comments that have come through on the text, on the grey foliage theme, one of the gardens in my care has a Fotheragillia cross intermedia blue shadow. Can it be pruned? And this is Mark from Central Coast of New South Wales.
Yes. Simple answer.
Yes.
Cut it where you want to.
Whenever you want to?
When it's growing.
Tell us about Fotheragillia, Craig. What's Fotheragillia?
They have little foxtail flowers in spring, white.
Okay.
It's a herbaceous. Deciduous shrub.
A shrub. Yeah, okay, yeah, so yeah, woody. Yeah,
They're sort of like hamamelis, a little, like the witch hazels, but a miniature witch hazel, multi-stem witch hazel.
But their outstanding feature is autumn colour, which is phenomenal.
Yeah, they're really pretty little bush. There's maybe three species available in Australia in the nurseries.
Yeah, Garden Eye. Intermediate and...
I can't remember the other one.
Yeah, no.
But there's... And like the smaller one, Garden Eye only gets up to about 5, 6, 7 feet at most.
If that. Yeah.
And then there's one that gets to maybe 12 feet.
That's right.
Couple of meters.
Needs to be pruned.
Yeah.
But the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you say, they've got little like bottle brush type flowers in late winter, early spring.
Just finishing up now.
Yeah. They're not spectacular, but they're nice, and then amazing autumn colour.
Beauty. So Fotheragillia intermedia, prune it.
Yeah, absolutely. They improve with pruning.
Hope that helps. Hope that helps, Mark.
Isn't that predictable from me?
Yes, it is, actually. In fact, there was a comment come through the text line saying Craig is hilarious. So I'd take that as a compliment, Craig.
Yeah, gardening's fun.
Yeah.
So we should make it hilarious from time to time.
Yes, indeed. We have a couple of community announcements this morning that I'll jump into. Today is the last day of the Yarra Valley Spring Plant Fair. We were going to do the Garden Show OB, but we're here in the studio. probably much warmer, much drier. And look, it was a little bit of a shame that yesterday was, you know, quite wet, but it didn't stop people from getting out to the fair. I believe it was a pretty successful day regardless. But today is the last day of the fair. The Yarra Valley Plant Fair is the last of the spring fairs. So it really is the last opportunity for 3CR listeners to get out to Wandon to tap into the specialist nurseries that are displaying their wares and selling their wares out at the plant fair. There's a good number of 3CR panellists that have got their plants out there. So it's that opportunity to have those discussions one-on-one with the growers, the specialist growers, and pick up some, you know, some really special and some quite unique plant material. Costa Georgiadis is the MC for the day today. It was Jane Edmondson yesterday, was out there at the Spring Fair. There are some student plant installations. So there's a couple of little mini display gardens. In fact, in many ways, the Yarra Valley Plant Fair and a good number of those plant fairs, they're sort of like mini country-styled MIFCUS displays. There's the talks, there's the workshops that are running throughout the day. And I'm imagining yesterday might have been a bit of a slower day, so great opportunity to get out there. I would imagine that there's going to be still a fair bit of stock out there. And a genuine opportunity to pick up some interesting plants at some probably likely pretty competitive prices. So brave the conditions. I mean, gardeners are pretty hardy souls. We love the rain.
Well, like Craig said before, this is, only gardeners look at a day like today and go,
so
oh,
you beauty. So last day of the Yarra Valley Spring Plant Fair. And that is 125 Quail Road, Wandon. Admission is $17 for adults, concession and kids. Concession tickets are $15 and kids under 14 are free. 125 Quail Road, Wandon. Head out there, catch up with some of the growers and say good day to Costa. Bev Hansen, as a part of the Open Garden Scheme, has her garden open today. Bev's property is at 104 Webb Street, Warrandyte. Bev's property is a 10-acre natural bush block with land for wildlife accreditation. So that's, you know, providing true habitat for local flora and fauna. Bev's garden is remarkable. She's been designing landscapes for decades, influenced by Ellis Stones, who she actually worked with in the 1960s. And, you know, Ellis Stones was one of the pioneers of that sort of naturalistic landscape movement. So there's elements of that sort of naturalistic landscape, Ellis Stone-esque, out at Bev Hansen's garden, 104 Webb Street, Warrandyte, as a part of the Victoria's Open Garden Scheme. Admission is $10, and for under 18s, that's free. That needs to be booked through Tribe Booking, so that's tribebooking.com to have a look at Bev's garden, which is an amazing landscape. A part of the blurb which says that you could actually go for a bushwalk in my garden, which is kind of lovely. sums up the garden really nicely. Kiss the Ground documentary is screening next weekend at the Fernie Creek Horticultural Society, Hilton Road, Sassafras. Kiss the Ground, we've chatted about it a little bit on the show here, but it's been organised by Ben and Kerry Brooker from Treasure Perennials, who will be out at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair. And it's really, it's a screening of a documentary and then a question and answer session after that. So the documentary will screen and then there will be a panel discussion talking about essentially regenerative agriculture. And look, I'll read this out because I think this is actually worth considering. This inspiring and groundbreaking documentary reveals that by regenerating our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climate, restore natural ecosystems, create abundant food supplies. Wow. So, encouraging through regenerating soils, stabilise climate, restore ecosystems and provide food. That ticks a whole number of boxes. You know, we're talking about affirmative action with respect to the climate stuff. I think for folks that are able to get out to the Kiss the Ground documentary, I think they'll leave there with some inspiration, but also a whole bunch of ideas to, you know, make a contribution to a better planet.
Yeah. There, if you can't get out there, there is a lot of stuff on YouTube, particularly surrounding that guy in Monaro, Massey. Peter Massey?
Yeah, okay.
Really good stuff on YouTube about him and how he's managing his property or managed his property.
Through regenerative agriculture.
Absolutely regenerative, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, blocking up streams, slowing them down.
Slowing them down, yeah.
Yeah, planting willows.
Planting willows. Hang on, that's controversial.
That's controversial. Anything to slow down the waterways.
Yeah. So the kind of the plant-based solutions.
That's right.
Yeah. You know, at the Botanic Garden Conference last year, you know, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, the implications of tipping over 1.5 degrees of global warming, heading towards 2 degrees. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of tools and resources and things that as gardeners and landscape managers working in botanic gardens and the like that we can actually do to it's an attempt to reconcile some of those things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as horticulturists and gardeners, you know, the affirmative action, I think, is... You know, it makes a very positive contribution to what sounds like a pretty wicked dilemma. Mm. So for folks that are interested in learning a bit more about that, Kiss the Ground documentary, Ferny Creek Horde Society, $15 a head, and the funds are coming back to 3CR. So that sounds really terrific. On November 30 at Ceres in Brunswick East, there's a native nature strip planting workshop. Participants will get to know their local council's guidelines for nature strip planting, develop a list of native plants that attract pollinators, and actually produce a detailed planting plan and a year-round maintenance schedule. So it sounds like a masterclass in nature strip planting. The workshop, there's actually a cost for this one. It's $94 or $85 for series members. And that is November the 30th at Ceres. We are just about on the edge of the event season for 2025. It's been an extraordinary one. I think we must have read out over 25 different events that have happened across the course of this spring. Just on the events, Vicky and Peter from Notting Hill actually opened their garden up to the public for the first time as a part of the Waverley Garden Club, the City of Monash Open Garden Scheme. Despite yesterday's pretty gnarly weather, it still had almost 200 visitors receive some lovely comments.
So, not surprising.
No, it's not, is it?
No.
There's a couple of questions here which I'll get to in a sec. So you're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott, joined today by Amy Downey from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Greg Wilson from Gentiana Nursery, and Greg Baldiston from Forest Glade Nursery. If you'd like to call in to the panel with a question or a comment, a gardening question or a comment, you can give us a call on 94190155. You could also text through a question or a comment to the 3CR text line, which is 0488 809 855. Greg, have you ever opened your garden?
I have. Not a process I enjoy.
Not a process you enjoy.
It's really hard work.
You like to spread your pruning out over the year, not doing it all.
Yeah, that's right.
A couple of weeks before the garden opens. Yeah.
But yeah, I have opened it in the past. There's a lot of talking involved. Yeah.
What is your garden like, Craig? I know you said you've got camellias, but what else are you kind of showing in there?
Oh, it's so many collections. Mm-hmm. Epimedium collection, fuchsia collection, all sorts of collections, yeah.
So shady? You've got kind of a shady...
Both, shade and sun, yeah. I don't do the naturalistic thing. I think gardens are an artifice and should be treated as such.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Except perhaps with a bush, Australian bush garden, I can get it. But mine's, you can't put a whole heap of plants from all four corners of the world into a bed and say it's natural. Yeah, so I do a lot of clipping.
Yeah. Like to do the pruning and...
I like the combination of formal and informal.
Yeah. Oh, sounds amazing.
Yeah. And it's a collector's garden.
It's a collector's garden. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. But I try to put it together in some sort of order. It's not completely insane.
just somewhat insane.
Yeah. I don't mind a wild garden. I love that.
Yeah. Oh, it's not wild.
Oh, not wild.
No. All managed.
All managed. Yep. Yeah. Beautiful.
But eclectic.
Yeah.
It's a bit like you. Wild, not so wild, but eclectic.
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah.
We actually had a couple of questions come through during the week on our email, which is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And interesting one for the panel. We've got Rob in Northcote, who's trying to remove Acanthus mollis from a garden bed. Every time he cuts it back or digs it up, it reshoots a few months later. Any tips for removing Acanthus mollis from a garden?
Learn to love it.
The only hope you've got is if there's nothing around it, so if that's all that's left in the garden bed and you want to get rid of it, you've got to cut the sunlight out, and that could take a couple of years to drain of it all of its energy.
But it grows well in the shade.
No, I mean like completely.
Oh, smother it.
So smother it. Yeah. You need to smother it.
Yeah.
Smother, as in how
black plastic.
Smother? Oh, I see.
Yeah, something right. Like that.
G-man?
Yeah, it, as long as it can't get through and can't get to the sunlight.
Yeah.
But that might take, what, two or three seasons even. Some if it's been there for a while and it's got, because they've got quite, rhizomy sort of fleshy roots on them.
Yeah.
And you've got to get all that energy out. You need to basically starve them is the only way I can think of.
How long would that process take?
It might take a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you've got nothing else.
Sorry. Yeah.
If you've got nothing else there, you can just lay a bit of black plastic down and forget about it for a couple of years.
And I've been brutal with it for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it keeps coming back. So yeah. I've just given up.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think your option is the one I would go for too, just like, well, it's there. What are you going to do?
Just make sure you cut the seed heads off.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah. Don't let it spread.
It spreads by seeds or does it spread vegetatively?
I've only noticed it ever spreading vegetatively, clumping. I don't think I've ever noticed it growing from seed anywhere before. Do you get it growing from seed?
We do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And there's quite a lot at the Botanic Gardens too, isn't there?
Yes, it's the same sort of battle that we've had, the same thing of trialing different things to see if we can get rid of it. But
has anything worked?
Not that I've heard. Someone did mention the other day they thought that they had sort of cut and painted a few times and that was successful, but I've tried the same thing in the Grey Garden and it was not successful for me at all.
Yeah,
but
been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I haven't. Probably the only thing we haven't tried is cutting it down and laying the plastic or something on top of it. So,
and then you have to love the black plastic for a year or two, right?
We've actually had, just on the events thing, we've actually got a couple of people that have phoned through with some additional events. We've got John Bentley, friend of the Melbourne Botanic Gardens. Are you there, John? John Bentley. Or is it Selma?
Oh, it could be.
Sorry, Selma. I got you confused with John Bentley. But it's
Just a minute. I'll put on my masculine voice.
Good on you, Selma. Selma, is there a rose show down at Lee and Gaffer that you want to chat about?
That's exactly right. We are running our annual rose show, and it'll be our 52nd annual one down at Lee and Gaffer. We're very renowned for our roses. And we're having it on the 15th and the 16th of November. And this year we're dedicating a tribute to our Alistair Clark roses.
Terrific.
Because, well, as you know, he was super, super Australian famous. And the roses that he has perfected for us to enjoy now are just amazing. You look at each one as it comes out and how he got the colours and the style of it is just, it's brilliant. So, yeah, so Reuben, your friend Reuben up there, he is delivering us Alistair Clark roses that will be for sale because his dad discovered them with Susan Irvine. He looked for them all over Australia and they put their collection together at Buller Alistair Clark Memorial Garden, which is amazing. One does have to visit that if they like roses.
Yep. Tell us the Alistair Clark story, Selma. What's so special about his roses?
Well, he came out from England and sort of was a daffodil grower, actually, as he started. Then he turned to creating roses for Australian conditions because the English, proper English roses weren't surviving that well. And he lived at Buller at Glenara, married well, and you've got the Alistair Clark Steak Rose race as well, because he was also into races. I think the gentry of that year enjoyed that sort of life as well. So all the roses are Australian bred, and they're for Australian conditions. Terrific. And they're just absolutely beautiful. So this year we've done a tribute to that. Yeah.
Tell us.
So it's on the 15th and the 16th of November at Leon Gaffer in the Dacres Centre, which is the elderly sits. Yep.
So fantastic. So Rose Show focusing on Alistair Clark roses.
Yeah, along with others, of course,
along
as
with
well,
others.
But that's where we have a feature rose. But let me tell you about what I did yesterday. I put my gumboots on and we had a big golf umbrella, and we went to, it is so sad, the volunteers at Morwell, they need a big pat on their back, and they're probably all in hospital with pneumonia today. and you mentioned Costa going, well, he'll be in hospital with them, because he was there doing his tricks as well.
Oh,
and
good on him.
He was drenched, and of course his hair was standing on end in a frizz, and it was so sad. You think, you know, they put all this year's work into this huge, big 2-day event they have down there, and the steam train brought all these people from Melbourne, and they had to wait till 3 o'clock to go back home. I don't know how. They'll all be in hospital in Melbourne too. It was so wet. It was so, so wet, and nowhere to hide.
Such hardy folks. Us gardeners.
Oh, we are. It doesn't matter. Pouring out sausage, you just got to do it. So thank you for letting me talk about it.
Terrific, Selma. I hope the Rose Show next week is a huge hit. I'm sure it will be. And I hope you get some better weather.
Well, it needs to be. Okay, thank you.
Okay, no worries, Selma. At all. Good on you. Thanks,
thank
Selma.
Thank you, panel.
See ya.
Bye.
And we have John Bentley on line 8. Let me just hang on for a second here. Are you there, John?
Well, it's me if I'm there.
Thanks, John. thanks for holding on. Thanks for holding on, mate.
It's interesting about Moe having that international Rose Show. I was driving back from Sale yesterday because I did done a bit of a road trip over the last 10 days. And it was absolutely bucketing down, so I just kept going on the freeway. So I do apologise for that to all the people in Morwell.
You've got an event next. You've got an event coming up at Melton Botanic Gardens.
No, I wanted to talk about an event I've been to, which is the gathering of all the prestigious people from Botanic Gardens from Australia and New Zealand, the Beegans Congress.
It was a great forum, wasn't it?
It was absolutely wonderful, and I think the highlight of the week was at the dinner when a person was well recognised for his contribution to Botanic Gardens, and that was John Arnott being inducted Woo-hoo! Into the Roll of Honour. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you, John. It took me a little bit by surprise. Well, it took me a whole lot by surprise, I must say.
You looked absolutely surprised because I was staggered. And I've known you for quite a long time. You were right there when we had the first public forum to discuss the idea of a botanic garden in Melton in 2003 and came back in 2004. And you've helped support the Melton Botanic Garden over the years with many things we've done and visited and things, yeah. But, yeah, I did a little trip, so I went up through, looked at Bonella Botanic Garden, Albury, and then I went to side trip to the Aircraft Museum in Tamora, but they had some nice gardens there. and then the Australian National Botanic Garden. And I think the highlight there was at the going to the Arboretum and seeing the bonsai collection, which was superb.
It was stunning, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh, it's absolutely amazing. It's a different thing to do with trees, I can tell you that. It's a lot of care and dedication. And then I came back through Sale and stayed there the night and went to the Botanic Garden there. So three of them were pretty classic things about what you imagine a botanic garden to be, with a guilfoil sort of design and sweeping lawns. Certainly the Australian National Botanic Garden is quite a lot different. Apart from the fact I got a bit fitter walking up all the hills, it was good coming down. But it's a different layout and a different structure and a more modern garden to the others. But
yeah, that's it. Yeah. I mean, botanic gardens come in all shapes and sizes and forms. And I guess the Congress is the gathering of the clan and getting together for a week. And it was a terrific week, John.
Oh, yeah, lots of information. So I've got lots to take away and look at as well. So, yeah, it was great to catch up with everyone. So I just want to say to everybody, happy gardening, no matter what the conditions are.
Thanks, thanks for calling in, John. Really appreciate
all right. it. Okay. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye. And on line, I can't talk this morning, line nine, we've got Peter Symes calling in. Are you down in Colac, Peter?
Hi, John. I hope this is good.
Yeah, no, it's good, Peter. We can hear you loud and clear.
I'm going to get feedback from myself on the phone, I think. That's all right.
If you need to adjust anything, Pete, just adjust away. Pete, for many years you've been supporting an Australian-based charity called the Global Garden for Peace, which has been doing some remarkable work, including some work in Gaza. You know, the whole philosophy about developing green landscapes to support well-being and manage post-traumatic stress and a whole bunch of other things. Pete, there's a campaign running at the moment that you're involved with. Do you want to mention that to the listeners of the 3CR show?
Yes, so I can give some brief background how this came about. So the original idea for green space in Gaza happened around 2007 when Maura Kelly visited Gaza and promised to come back and build play spaces for children, because all they essentially had was, you know, broken down playground equipment with very little green space. And I've been into Gaza twice, in 2013 and 2015, but it was very difficult to develop any green space in essentially what is a war zone.
Mm.
And but it's got to the point of looking at how else can we help the people there. And I've been providing support to I suppose you'd call them communities of practice, but there's an organisation called GUPAP, which is the Gaza Urban and Peri-Urban Agricultural Platform. And there's also an Urban Women Agripreneurs Forum. The amazing thing is there's women there who are mostly women who are trying to grow food in very difficult circumstances, as you can imagine.
Yeah, sure.
And interestingly, they also have a seed bank where they're growing Baladi seeds, which are local seeds suited to the conditions. So they've got heritage plants, which they're trying to grow from seed, and in very difficult environments, rooftops, you know, where there's rubble, where there's any soil that they can actually grow plants. And using water, you know, recycling, imagine water being very scarce, they're recycling water from washing and, you know, cups of water on plants to grow them, and supporting their families, but also as a way of potentially getting some revenue for other things that they need. So providing just some support to these groups to facilitate the support for these women and their families.
Yeah, it's look, I think though, all of us in the studio are just listening to this intently. It's a pretty powerful project, Peter.
Well, yes, I find myself being personally inspired by women like this and other people that I deal with in other parts of the world. It's a temptation when you live in a more wealthy country to focus on the things that you're not doing or things you would like to do better, and particularly in botanic gardens or public parks and gardens context, we'll complain about lack of money and resources, and I see women like this who are essentially got next to no resources are still having a crack at growing plants for their direct health, but also for well-being. I think any sort of green plant growing in Gaza is going to be offering more than just food. It's offering hope and a better future, and these are people with next to nothing who are still doing things. So when we're complaining about having no resources and we can't do anything, I think people like this actually show leadership to me, and it makes me get off my backside and do things.
Yeah. Pete, how can 3CR listeners find out more about the Gaza Urban and Peri-Urban Agriculture Program, and particularly the Women Entrepreneurs Forum? And how can folks, you know, contribute to that or support that in any way?
So there's a website called Sustain, but if people search using the words Gaza Sustain Seeds, I'm sure they'll pull up the website, and yep. That's easy to remember.
Yep.
So if I just type in Gaza Sustain Seeds, I think they'll find the site. It's essentially about trying to raise money. So these seeds can be grown on and distributed and potentially purchased, but there is an emphasis on local varieties, the Baladi varieties, which are suited heritage seeds. All of them are open-pollinated and suited for the conditions that are there. There's a couple of events coming up, campaign events, which will be terrific to get a good showing of people there who are focused on plants and gardens and people. And there's an event on the 25th of November and also the 27th of November. The details are actually on the website, but they're respectively be held in Coburg and Footscray, and they're evening events. So if people want to find out more, come up face-to-face with people, they'd be good events to go to. But the website essentially has all the information that people need. And, you know, to encourage Australian gardeners everywhere to have a look and, you know, we're focused on just people, plants and food growing. That's what this is all about. It's apolitical. We're not getting into politics. We're just looking at the bare necessities for people who are so desperate for help.
Well, good on you, Peter Symes, for getting behind the cause. If people are interested in finding out more about the program, which just sounds, incredible,
yeah,
confronting and challenging and a whole bunch of other things, but like you say, there is something about plants and hope, and that's what's really driving. Is that what's driving you, Pete, to get involved with this?
Yes, I think plants bring hope, and in my experience as a horticulturist, that when you're using plants as the basis for your communication and talking to people, it tends to push away all the other things that cause conflict and disagreement, because it's a very most grounding basis. And I think, you know, I have this belief that if people who grew plants run the world, we'd have a much more peaceful and operable world. And I think horticulturists have actually extremely good communicators because we work on what the issues are. So I think for the people there, it's easy just to give up and think it's just too hard. But for people who are trying to still grow plants and seeing seed germinate and green push out of the soil, it does indicate hope for a better future for those women and also for the children that are helping them. I think it's something in any areas of destruction or
trauma
or areas of poverty, plants provide a mechanism for at least having some hope for the future.
Powerful words, Pete. Thank you so much for calling in this morning. If people want to find out as Peter has suggested, type in Gaza Sustain and Seeds, and it'll take you pretty close to the website, which has got all the information about it. Pete, you're a champion.
John, can I leave you one last line?
Please, yes, please.
Yeah. We questioned this when we went to Gaza, thinking about, you know, whether this was a high need for people or anything else. And we spoke to people there, and one of the government representatives we were working with said to us that people in Gaza see gardens as a metaphor like lifeboat for drowning people. So that was the statement. That's how important the green spaces were to them. So I think that's something that we can all take away.
Amazing, Peter. You're a you're a good man, Peter Symes. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
If people want to find out, just jump on the website, type in Gaza, Sustain It and Seeds, and get behind the program. You're a champ, Pete. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. Okay, bye.
Cheers for now, mate. Imagine if, yeah, I know, extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if gardeners ran the world.
Yeah.
It would be a very different place.
I love that. I haven't heard that before, but I love it. I completely agree.
Tim Sampson, now Executive Director at the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, I think it was the last article that he did in the Diggers newsletter, he posed the question, what if gardeners around the world? and it was about 12 months ago. I think it'd be worthwhile getting Tim in to talk just to that question.
Yes, yeah.
Because it'd be a different place, wouldn't it?
I just find it astonishing that people living in those conditions can think about sowing seed.
Yeah. Well, yes, I know, it's extraordinary.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a look at that website last night, if people have got the capacity to and the wherewithal to, you know, have a look at it and consider contributing to the cause, it would be a good thing to do. It's a remarkable project. You know, we talk about cause. You know, you couldn't think of a more compelling cause globally at the moment than supporting that one.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you know, great. The Global Gardens for Peace is a remarkable organisation. And you know, Peter was there at the very start of that. So you know, he's an incredible individual, Peter Symes, and doing some remarkable work. As are you, Amy Downey.
Oh. Thank you.
Last week, there was a featured article in The Guardian by Guardian environmental reporter Tori Shepherd, and it was entitled Gum Nuts Baby, How Two Abseiling Horticulturists Rescued Specimens from an Endangered Tree. The article goes on to say, two horticulturists have undertaken a daring abseiling mission to rescue gum nuts from an endangered tree off a 300-metre cliff face. The endangered tree in question was the Gilliger ash, Eucalyptus themistoma. The location of the mission to collect seeds from that endangered species was Wadbilliga National Park?
Yes.
In southern New South Wales. And the two horticulturists undertaking the mission were Ollie Sherlock from the Cranbourne Gardens and Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne horticulturist and now 3CR Garden Show panellist Amy Downey. What a remarkable thing. How did all that happen? How did you find yourself abseiling down a 300-metre escarpment to collect seeds off Eucalyptus themistoma, one of the most endangered eucalypts on planet Earth?
Oh, it's just so crazy, actually. And even how we got there was kind of wild. But it kind of goes back to last year. I attended the 8th Global Botanic Gardens Congress in Singapore and did a presentation there on sort of the abseiling and climbing we had been doing at the Botanic Gardens, which was the Grey Garden Escarpment that I spoke about earlier. Myself and my team leader, Tim Ubergang, had both sort of learned to abseil and climb to access this escarpment and use it to kind of host ex situ collections of endangered species, as well as other, you know, displaying other native cliff-dwelling species and things like that. So I did a presentation and amazingly, Russell Lark, who also has been on the show, was at this was at the presentation at the conference as well. And he had a connection at Threatened Species Conservancy, who had taken on this work to go into Woodbilliga and do a national park, and sort of were looking at species that had been affected by the 2019-2020 bushfires that had sort of burnt through there.
Through that country, yeah.
Yeah, the Black Saturday fires. And so they had been doing some work going in and sort of surveying species that had been affected, and they had found this Eucalyptus stenostoma, which had now become endangered because it doesn't regenerate from fire.
Okay, yeah. So it doesn't reshoot.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't regenerate from epicormic growth or a lignotuber.
Okay.
So it had been really, really affected, and it sort of is growing in a spot, I think, anyway, you could tell that it didn't like fire because it was at the top of this very sort of steep ridge and then on these cliff faces as well. So they knew sort of because it had been so affected, they needed to collect seed as sort of a backup to store in the...
Off the material that didn't burn.
Yes,
off
exactly.
Mature plants.
Which
right.
was only really... There were a few large trees that had survived, and then there were mainly remaining sort of population on this 300-metre cliff face. So they had sort of seen this and been like, how on earth are we going to get to it? And so that's where it all sort of came about. They were speaking, so the trip leader, Stan, who sort of is in charge of this project, was speaking with Russell Lark and said, do you know anybody who could climb, who could abseil, who could help? And that's how it came about. He said, oh, actually, I just went to this presentation and, yeah, Amy and Tim have been doing climbing, and then it evolved from there where Ollie also is an extremely experienced climber.
Rock climber, yeah.
Yeah, so amazing that I could have him with me to sort of guide me, I guess, in that unique sort of climbing because it's still, you know, relatively new for me. As well.
What an extraordinary thing. when you started your apprenticeship at the Melbourne Botanic Gardens, did you ever imagine that you'd be in southern New South Wales, abseiling down an escarpment to collect the threatened species?
No, absolutely. So the whole thing as well was just incredible. You know, it was four-wheel driving, which I haven't done much of either, and camping, and, yeah, then this climbing and collecting and, you know, having to even come up with these unique techniques to collect the branches and the seed so that, you know, you're on this 300-metre cliff face. If you chop it, it's then going to fall down the cliff face. So, yeah, just all these different sort of things you never would have considered. And, again, going back to as an apprentice, I never thought I would end up here. And I'm so glad that I did. What a crazy journey, right? You can never predict.
Fabulous workspace.
Yes, absolutely.
Extreme plant collection. Yeah. You could almost do a series on it.
Yeah, yeah. Extreme horticulture.
Extreme horticulture.
Yes, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, very cool.
How many plants? Did you? Were there a number of trees? Because if you just collected off one tree, you might not get a representative sample. Did you have to collect off a few things?
Yeah, so we actually ended up collecting in total of 14 different trees.
Cool.
But on the cliff face, so also I should mention that this eucalypt only grows in Woodbilliga National Park and Dewar National Park, which are sort of neighbouring national parks. So that's the only place it occurs, which is well.
So southern New South Wales.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. Which I think, again, is why it's so endangered because it's not sort of widespread. But, yeah, so we collected off a few of the taller trees at the top of the ridge. So we were sort of in the back of the ute with these polelopers trying to reach these sort of fruits that were right at the top of the tree, of course. And then four different ones down the cliff faces on sort of two different locations as well. And then Threatened Species Conservancy ended up moving on as well to Dewar National Park, and we're able to get a couple of collections from there too.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So the seed is collected. Where does it go?
Yes. So we now have it, and we are growing on a couple of specimens to go both on the Grey Garden Escarpment and then also another species we're going to sort of plant in a lawn to have a comparison of how it grows on the cliff face versus on the flat.
And you'll go to the lawn, yep.
Yes. And then also one's going to be growing on at Cranbourne in the Australian Garden.
Terrific.
And we will store some seed in our nurseries. But sort of the main thing is that Eurobadella was also a massive sort of contributor to this trip and worked really closely with Threatened Species Conservancy. So they are also going to be growing on a few specimens and storing the seed. And then the New South Wales Herbarium are also going to be storing most of the seed. And we took some pressings and dry pressings for them to have in their herbarium.
How remarkable.
Yeah, so as a backup.
Lots of moving parts. There's the Conservancy, there's the Eurobadella Botanic Garden.
Yes.
There's the it all came together at the Singapore Congress.
Yes, and even, you know, we had a ranger from the New South Wales Park Ranger with us and a local expert who sort of lives at the bottom of this national park. And then as well, now that we have these sort of seeds, we're hoping to also open it up to other gardens and botanic gardens who might potentially want to grow on this species too. So a massive collaboration, which I think was also one of the major successes of the trip and one of the really exciting things about it. So hoping to even involve more people and, keep expanding.
Fantastic to have it growing in your grey garden too.
I was so excited about that. I think it's going to be incredible to kind of have the story from beginning to end.
Yeah. It's something you've collected seed from.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
How long's the seed viable for? How long can the seed be stored? Is it something
I actually don't know. I think it's a pretty long time. Like, I think even for us, like, having it in our nurseries in the fridge, they're expecting a fair few years that it will be stored for. But I have to admit, I actually don't know the full length of time.
Yeah, because it's such a variation in plant species, isn't there, of how long they're viable for. Yeah.
You get,
like, a magnolia that's 5,000 years or... You can have other things that are like cyclamen, which are, what, a month?
I promise it's a bit longer than a month. But that's something Stan, again, the project leader, had done a lot of the research on. Yeah. So I think it is quite a long time that it can be stored for, but I couldn't tell you the exact time.
Yeah.
But
it's kind of strange for a eucalypt not to regenerate from fire. I just thought that was Eucalyptus regnans and that was it.
This one, I think that was sort of the main concern.
Absolutely.
Again, obvious, I think once you sort of go up there and see where it's growing, it's definitely sort of giving itself the best chance to escape these fires and these hot fires. So, again, it was just such a shame. I think the fire burnt so hot that it really, really struggled. So
temperate rainforest or what?
What's the word? It's like a eucalypt rainforest. It starts with S. The
sclerophyll.
That's the one. Yeah. Yes.
A sclerophyll eucalypt forest.
That's the one. Yeah.
What a remarkable thing.
Incredible. Yeah.
Good on you, Amy. It's a great story.
Much.
If people want to have a read of the article, it was in last week's Guardian.
Yes.
And the article is called "Gumnuts Baby: How Two Abseiling Horticulturists Rescued Specimens from an Endangered Tree." And the horticulturist in question is Amy Downey and Ollie Sherlock from the Cranbourne Gardens. Great story.
Thank you.
We've got Kerry Brooker from out at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair on the line talking about events. Are you there, Kerry?
Good morning, John. Good morning, everybody.
Sorry, we left you hanging on the line there for a while, Kerry.
That's okay. We're actually just fixing our stall up, ready for everyone to come out in the sunshine today, and it is sunny out here now.
Thanks for calling in. Were you calling in about the Kiss the Ground documentary?
I was.
Great.
So if I can just give it one last plug. So it's on next weekend, November the 15th. It's from 11:30 to 4 p.m. We've got the screenings at 1 o'clock and we've got a Q&A session afterwards with Craig Castry, Ben Brooker and Marty Roden from QC Flower Farm as panellists to do the Q&A session afterwards. We've got, beforehand, we've got some stalls. So Inga from the Fernie Creek Horticultural Society propping shed is opening the propping shed for an hour beforehand between 11 and 12 to sell plants. Craig Castry will be there selling his books. ECOS will be there with native plants and biochar. Sarah from Salat will be there selling individual plant seedlings. We'll be having a plant stall there, and Fernie Creek will be selling food, probably a barbecue. So people can either bring their lunch or buy some food off Fernie Creek Horticultural Society. And then we've got four demonstrations. So Craig from Edible Gardens is demonstrating how to use a refractometer. Ben will be making lactobacillus. Marty Roden from QC Flower Farm will be demonstrating how to use a broad fork and talking about living pathways. And Paul Day from View Gardens is demonstrating aerobic tea making. So the day is sort of designed... Oh, and Meryl has come on board from Seedscape. She's actually given me a whole lot of vouchers. They're worth $20, which we'll be selling for $15. And she has a variety of ornamental edibles, but you can use the vouchers to purchase anything on her website. So, and the money raised from those vouchers is going back to the 3CR Radiothon, as are all the funds raised from the ticket sales for this event. So, yeah, so the day's designed to educate and inspire people to garden in a healthier manner, both for themselves and the planet. So, and it's all volunteers, and all the money's going to 3CR. So,
remarkable, Kerry. We were chatting earlier in the show just about how things like the Kiss the Ground documentary, the regenerative agriculture, mechanisms for some affirmative action, you know, making a contribution to a healthier planet. And good on you and Ben for getting behind it and sort of supporting the cause and be the 3CR Garden Show. So,
can I just tell people how to purchase tickets?
Please, yes.
So tickets, it's a ticketed event because we need to know how many seats we're hiring. So you can go to Try Booking and search Kiss the Ground by Treasured Perennials, or if you go on our Instagram or Facebook page, it's all over our Facebook. There's a QR code on there. And Craig from Edible Gardens, Craig Castry from Edible Gardens, he has a lot on his social media pages as well. So, yeah, so hopefully it'll be a great day.
Wonderful, Kerry. Hope today's a great day too. Folks, get out to the Kiss the Ground documentary next week if you're interested. You can get tickets to Try Booking. And thanks again, Kerry, for supporting the show.
Thank you very much.
Good on you.
Bye.
Thanks,
okay,
Kerry.
See ya. Also at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair, we have Chloe Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on, I'm just going to bring Chloe in. Are you there, Chloe?
Good morning. Morning, everyone.
How are you, Chloe?
I'm good, up bright and early again and hanging out at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair today.
What are you doing out there, Chloe?
Oh, flogging my book. I have a stall. I have a marquee with Sandra Swartz, fellow 3CR team member, and we've got the Rookie Gardener and we've got Restore here available for listeners. At the show today, and the sun's like out almost. It's so much better than yesterday. So if anyone was put off by the weather yesterday, I completely understand. But it's clear now. So today is the day. Yeah, for sure.
Terrific.
For sure.
Well, just to recap, both the Rookie Gardener and Restore. A stall to sell both of those, and both you and Sandra, you know, 3CR stalwarts. Book sales are going okay, Chloe. It's a terrific book. Apparently, it's very relevant.
Oh, is that you've changed your tune a little bit, John Arnott, compared to a couple of weeks ago? You told me it was irrelevant. That's yeah, glad you changed tune. Thank you,
folks. The backstory there was at the launch of Chloe's book. Chloe asked me to say a few words and sort of MC the conversation. And, you know, I've given it a fair bit of thought and I went to talk about the, you know, the funny nature of the book, and it's a little bit irreverent. And guess what came out? And I said, you know, there's points of irrelevance all the way through the book, and I don't think I'll ever live that one down, Chloe Foster.
I'm never going to ask you to be MC again.
No, no, fair call. Costa out there at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair today.
Yeah, big coup. Costa is here today. Costa will be sort of floating around talking to visitors. So if anyone's ever wanted to meet Costa, like, it's a pretty good opportunity to do it today.
Terrific.
There's, you know, heaps of other stalls here, some 3CR team of Tonkin Bulbs and Perennials, and Terry Brooker was just on, Meryl Johnson and Seedscape. Meryl's been floating around, but they haven't got a stall this year. And, gosh, there's so much. There's Fair Dinkum Fertilisers and beautiful woodwork businesses. So many nurseries. I reckon there's a couple of new nurseries this year that haven't been here before. I haven't noticed them. And just, you know, selling really unique plants that you don't get everywhere, and, you know, the whole thing of supporting small business in any capacity too. So also my Cert 4 students I've been working them really hard.
Okay.
And they've produced three absolutely beautiful, unique planting displays that are here as well to give visitors a little bit of inspiration around what they could create in their own gardens. And Clive and the team awarded it the best display after the show last night. So I can't wait to tell the students that. Some of them are here today as well to talk about what they've created and why. So, and Chiz and Tafe is here too with some student-led plant displays and some information. So if anyone's interested in studying horticulture, there's two Tafes here representing the industry. If anyone wants some more information on that.
Terrific, Chloe. Well, I hope the day goes well. I hope it stays a little bit drier than yesterday. It's Quail Road in Wandon, Yarra Valley Plant Fair, the last day of the plant fair, and as we mentioned earlier in the show, it's the last of the sort of the plant fair, so that last opportunity for a good number of months to have that one-on-one discussion with some of those specialist growers.
Yeah, 100%. And just to reiterate John Bentley's congratulations, the Botanic Gardens, on a roll that you were inducted onto.
Yeah. We're losing the line.
I've never seen you speechless. Don't do this to me. I've never seen you speechless before. It was a truly unique experience and very well deserved. It's really nice that we can honour you before you become completely irrelevant in your old age.
I resemble that remark, Chloe.
Over and out, John.
Thanks so much, Chloe. Good on you.
Catch you later.
See you later.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
I will never live that down in a book launch to say that the book is completely irrelevant. dearie dear. We've had a question in about the website for the event and the Gaza project that Peter Simons mentioned earlier. If you Google Sustain Gaza, you'll get to the website. But the website is actually sustain.org.au/local-community-food-production-in-Gaza. But I actually think Sustain Gaza or Sustain. Type in sustain.org.au and that'll take you to the take you to the project. So jump on, have a look at the website if you're so inclined. And Virginia has just put a note up here to say that we will put Amy's article onto the 3CR social medias.
Oh, thank you very much.
Because it's a cracking article.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's a cracking article.
Thank you. They did a good job. It was pretty cool to see.
They did a really good job. We're rapidly running out of time, but you wanted to mention in terms of sourcing, and sometimes you get some beautiful surprises when you're doing the propagating.
Seed raising is it's always a bit of a gamble, but it's so much fun when you get something which is quite difficult to obtain, and you think the seed is going to be difficult to raise, and the seed pods erupt. It's just fantastic. One of the early ones at my place was the dove tree, Davidia involucrata, which I thought, because it's quite a rare tree, that it would be a challenge.
They're pretty good when you get them going, though, aren't they?
Yeah, but the, honestly, 100% take.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's one, I was up at Long Acres the other day, and there's one that I raised from seed 20 years ago that's now flowering.
Yeah.
Which is, fantastic.
Incredible.
Yeah.
It's good enough when you get those propagation successes when you're not expecting it.
That's right.
Well, the other side of seeds too, especially when I was growing bulbs, is the natural variation you get in things, and bulbs are a bit sort of showier, I guess, in that way. And, you've sowed a colchicum seed and it might take 5 years to germinate, might take 8 years to germinate, and then it might take another 8 years for it to get to flowering size or something. And then when it finally flowers and you see it for the first time and it's got a little variation on it that's not in any of the books you've ever seen this thing flowering in, and it's just a little bit different. It's a bit exciting.
Yeah. Lovely.
Yeah. Long-term investment.
Yeah, for sure.
For people who are frightened of seed raising, which I think there's quite a lot, I mean, I was initially, just give it a go.
Give it a go.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter if they don't come up. Chuck it out and try something else.
Yeah. Top tips for seed raising?
Keep them dry.
Hang on. Keep them dry.
Well, when I say dry, not too wet.
Not too wet.
Really easy to rot seeds.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, moist.
Moist, yeah, but not wet. The biggest killer of seed is too much water, I think.
Yeah. And even after they've germinated too, absolutely. Too much water is going to probably do more damage.
Yeah. So you need to raise them under shelter, not out in the open.
Okay. Yeah. So gentle conditions, filtered light,
humid,
not too wet.
Or, you know, some humidity.
Some humidity.
Yeah.
Beautiful. We've got a question come in from Michael in Melbourne. Has a tree poppy that was transplanted a year ago. It grew very well in the first spring and is now getting bigger and suckering. Removed about a dozen suckers, and although the main body of the plant is in bud, several central stems are turning yellow and dying. How should he treat that? So it's a tree poppy, central stems are turning yellow and dying. He's removed the suckers.
Romularia, is it?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Romularia, if it's suckering.
Yeah, yep. If it's suckering.
Other, I don't think is it Fromontodendrons, another tree poppy, I think?
Yeah.
I don't think that'd sucker. They're pretty tough, I think, once they've established themselves. I think you can, if it looks a bit crappy, you can cut it down. And if it's starting
when
to
sucker... When you say cut it down, would that be cut down to the ground halfway?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
So, and then the ground. New ones will come
the
up.
The new shoots come up from the ground.
Okay.
If it's starting to sucker, though, I think you'll have potentially more of a problem keeping up with the pruning. Yeah, because they can be quite aggressive.
I put it in my garden and, I got rid of it in the end.
Yeah.
Too wild.
It does, it can sucker quite a long distance
too.
It can, run underneath a driveway and come up on the other side. Sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a
they are beautiful though.
Yeah, so it's a great colonising plant by the sound.
Yeah,
yeah.
I remember hearing someone who put it through a chipper because they're quite hard to propagate. They're notoriously hard to propagate and get going as a living plant. But once they're going, they're real tough.
Yeah.
Mm. And this guy was pruning them, or he wanted to get rid of them, I think, and he dug up the whole lot and run them through the wood chipper and put the mulch on the garden bed, and now he had like half an acre of them.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah.
A cautionary tale.
But if you're in the nursery and you want to propagate five plants to sell at a profit, you can't get them going.
Yeah. Okay. It's always the way. Yeah.
That's a unique way of propagating. Put it through the wood chipper and distribute it across your garden.
It works for ash tree.
Yeah, it certainly works for a few things.
And sycamore.
We should start the wind-up. I can't believe that 105 minutes has just disappeared. You've been listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I hope today's been interesting and informative. I'd really love to thank the panellists for today's show, Craig Wilson, and both Craig and Greg brought in some plants, and I'm sorry that we didn't get to them. It was just jam-packed. So Craig from Gentiana Nursery, thanks for coming in this morning, mate.
It's a pleasure.
Greg Balderston, ecologist, mycologist, horticulturist, field naturalist. Interested individual. Thanks for coming in, Greg.
No worries.
Good on you. Really appreciate that.
Yep.
And for the first time, Amy Downey from the Royal Botanic Gardens, Victoria, Grey Garden and Camellia Curator. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me share my field trip. It was so much fun.
It's a pleasure. Have a look to the socials for the article in the Guardian. It's a cracking article. Extreme plant collection. Okay, good on you, Amy.
Thank you.
You've been great. Thanks to Peter Symes.
Yes.
A remarkable project, the Global Gardens from Peace and the Gaza stuff.
Incredible.
It is incredible. Yeah. So please feel free to jump onto that website and have a look. It is a remarkable project and a very needy one. So thanks for Peter for calling in and discussing that with the panel. Huge thanks to PR and to Doug, who've been doing the producing for this morning's show.
Thank you.
Daniel Jackson and Liam Killick for their support with social media. Next week's show looks terrific. We've got Emma Hurd chatting with Penny Woodward, Karen Sutherland, Chris Williams. So it's a bit of a produce garden masterclass next weekend. Stick around for the alternative news, and happy spring gardening, folks. See you next time.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.